3, 2, 1.
What will the world look like 10 or 20 years from now? The Wall Street Journal's Future of Everything podcast is here to give you a peek. And we can't wait to show you what's coming. Subscribe now.
Citing inflation and the war in Ukraine, the World Bank cuts its global growth forecast. Plus, the Twitter takeover buzz heats up, and why homeowners and investors are increasingly squaring off in the suburbs.
You're seeing all over the country investors increasing their interest in buying homes in single-family suburban communities. And so homeowners groups are looking around and wondering how long until some of these companies will control our neighborhood.
It's Tuesday, April 19th. I'm Luke Vargas with The Wall Street Journal. Here's the AM edition of What's News, the top headlines and business stories moving your world today. The Pentagon says there is active fighting in eastern Ukraine's Donbas region. Pentagon Press Secretary John Kirby says that Russia is in the preliminary phase of a broader campaign.
Just over the last several days, you can continue to see the Russians are doing what we call shaping. They're trying to set the conditions for more aggressive, more overt, and larger ground maneuvers in the Donbas.
Earlier, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said Russian forces had launched their anticipated offensive in Donbas, pointing to what is expected to be a brutal new phase of the nearly 8-week war. Rising energy and food prices, the war in Ukraine, and China's COVID-related shutdowns will lower the global economy's growth rate this year, the World Bank has said ahead of its spring meetings this week. The bank, one of the biggest multinational lenders to lower-income countries, cut its economic growth forecast for this year to 3.2%, down from a January forecast of 4.1%. The U.S. has made more than 1 million arrests at the U.S.-Mexico border over the last 6 months, marking the fastest pace of illegal border crossings in at least the last 2 decades. That's according to new data released by U.S. Customs and Border Protection. Border agents made more than 209,000 arrests along the border in March alone. The record numbers come as the Biden administration prepares to lift a pandemic-era policy that allows border agents to quickly turn away people arrested trying to enter the U.S. illegally, as well as those who seek asylum at a border checkpoint. We are exclusively reporting that Apollo Global Management is considering participating in a bid for social media company Twitter, according to people familiar with the matter. That news follows Elon Musk's $43 billion bid for Twitter. Apollo, one of the world's largest buyout firms and the owner of Yahoo, has held discussions about backing a possible deal for Twitter and could provide backing for Musk or another bidder to support an offer, the people said. There is no guarantee Twitter would be receptive to that or any other deal. Journal Markets editor Quinton Webb says that despite the reported interest in Twitter, the company remains an unusual target for a possible takeover.
At this point, it's quite difficult to discern exactly what the shape of any deal to take over Twitter would take. And actually, Twitter is a very atypical target for a big private equity deal because it doesn't have the sort of stable cash flows that you would typically look for in a private equity buyout target. Those cash flows generally allow private equity firms to leverage up their deals, to minimize the amount of equity. They put in a lot of debt and to help juice their returns. Twitter doesn't quite fit that profile.
Twitter will report earnings on April 28th and could detail its stance on Musk's offer to buy the company then. And union organizers at an Amazon facility in New Jersey have won the right to hold an election, marking the newest union push since workers at a New York warehouse voted to establish the company's first union in the U.S. earlier this month. The terms and dates for the election in New Jersey have yet to be determined. An Amazon spokeswoman said the company is looking into the matter. An attorney listed as representing the Local 13 International Brotherhood of the Trade Union, which filed for the vote, didn't immediately respond to a request for comment. Could aging coal power plants soon house nuclear reactors? Well, following lobbying efforts by U.S. utilities and startups, more than a dozen states this year are considering legislation that could open the door to coal-to-nuclear conversions as a part of the search for new sources of reliable and renewable energy. But just how feasible is this idea? Journal Energy reporter Jennifer Hiller has been looking into that question, and she joins us now with more. Hey, Jennifer.
Hi there.
So what is being proposed here exactly, and by whom?
So the idea of this is that you would take a coal plant that is shutting down, which we have many of, and you would end up placing small modular nuclear reactors on site. And you would maybe reuse potentially some of the equipment, but more importantly, the grid connections, the substations and the transmission lines and that kind of thing that connect that plant to the grid, but that you would take a coal site and turn it into a nuclear site. This is an idea that's coming from utilities and the developers of small modular reactors, and it's also being tossed around by a lot of think tanks in the industry.
Okay, and so what are all these players sort of saying makes this a realistic and good idea?
I think the main issues are that you have these coal plants that are closing down that have an experienced workforce. So you could tap into the workforce, you could save some jobs and help out local economies, and that you would reuse the site in a sense that you have these valuable grid connections that are there and that you could do something with that. And then that you would be replacing coal essentially with a cleaner energy, that, you know, nuclear is a no carbon way to make electricity. So the idea behind modular nuclear reactors is that they are smaller and faster to build. So you would have a first prototype that would prove up this technology, but that these are smaller and that you would almost make them in a factory type setting. And that would be how you would keep your costs down, would be by volume. You would make more of these and that they would be easier and faster to do than the big sort of hulking large nuclear plants that we have right now.
And what do opponents and skeptics say about this idea?
I think there's a lot of skeptics out there. There's a lot of people who like this idea who are skeptical themselves. And a lot of it boils down to just the cost and the time frame for building any nuclear project. It tends to take a long time and be really expensive. There are often cost overruns. And then there are also, you know, potential safety hurdles and things like that. You've got a long licensing process at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and you would potentially have some local opposition because you would be using radioactive materials and bringing that into a community that doesn't have that right now. And there's a lot of debate about how quick they can develop and build these and get them through approvals and into use. So I think that remains to be seen.
That was Journal Energy reporter Jennifer Hiller. Jennifer, thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Coming up, a battle is heating up in the suburbs between homeowners associations and investors who have been increasingly snapping up real estate. We'll look at why tensions are running high and why some say banning investors and renters could have unintended consequences after the break.
What then will the future reveal?
There's one thing we know about the future. It's being built now.
We all have a stake in the future.
The future.
The future.
The future.
And the Wall Street Journal's Future of Everything podcast is here to give you a glimpse of what's on the way. I'm Danny Lewis. Join us as we dig into how science and technology are shaping the future.
For that is where you and I are going to spend the rest of our lives.
Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
An increasing number of American homeowners in the suburbs are fed up with investors buying up neighboring properties, and they want to keep them out. Rules limiting investor purchases in buildings are already common in some condominium and cooperative housing communities, especially in New York City. But now, as WSJ housing reporter Will Parker writes, homeowners in the suburbs are using whatever leverage they can cobble together via their homeowners associations to achieve a similar result and try and keep investors away. And Will joins us now with more. Hey, Will.
Hey, Luke.
I'm certain that some people heard the intro to this story and are already nodding along. They feel that this is an issue too. But for anyone who's not familiar with this firsthand, take us into this issue, at least from the perspective of some of these homeowners who are so frustrated?
So on the one hand, this is a tension that's existed in suburban neighborhoods for a very long time. This sense among homeowners, or the feeling that, you know, renters don't have the same financial incentives that homeowners do, and therefore don't invest as much in the property, or they don't keep it up the same way that everyone else does. And there's been a long history of homeowners associations trying to fight off the incursion of too many renters in their neighborhood. But what's different now is that there are so many more rentals in a lot of places. You're seeing all over the country investors increasing their interest in buying homes in single-family suburban communities, and they're doing about as much of it as they ever have now. And so homeowner groups are noticing that and looking around and wondering how long until some of these companies will control our neighborhood. There's the sense that renters don't preserve the housing as well as the homeowners do because they have different financial incentives. And I think a lot of these homeowner groups also feel like they want to preserve the opportunity for families to own in their communities and to have neighbors who are invested long term in those same communities. And I think that's leading to a lot of what we're seeing now with homeowners trying to restrict how much investors can buy.
So, Will, why are investors so eager to buy into these neighborhoods and get into suburban real estate?
As of December, it's like one in every five homes that sells to an investor. I mean, depending on how exactly you measure it, this is something that it spiked a few times in the past, but is now as high or higher than it's ever been. The demand for housing during the pandemic has been really strong, and the prices for homes have been increasing really quickly. I mean, what's happening is you have a lot of demand for these homes, but a shrinking number of people who can afford to buy them. To get a down payment for a suburban house is really challenging right now. So there's just a large audience of customers who are wanting for that type of home, but are going to have to rent it instead of buy it.
And so what is the strategy we're seeing from homeowners to try and push back against this? And are we seeing that they actually have the power to do something?
So in a lot of states, the homeowners associations have pretty broad powers to set rules, not only about how people have to maintain their properties, but what they can do with them. We've seen rules against short-term rentals, Airbnbs and that sort of thing become very common. But there's also the power often to restrict long-term rentals. And the way a lot of these communities are looking to do it is to put in, for example, an owner occupancy rule. So if you buy a house in one of these communities, you have to live there for 1, 2, or even 3 years before you'd be allowed to rent it. Something like that pretty much automatically excludes an out-of-state corporate investor, right? A large company is not going to move into a house, so to speak. So that's one of the main ways that they are seeking to exclude more investors. Some other ways they are doing it include, in some cases, having homeowners associations approve people's rental applications, which can make the process of being a landlord a lot more burdensome and certainly discourage, I think, some investors from wanting to try to operate in such a community.
And I would imagine that realtors don't exactly love this. Is that right?
The real estate industry, the people who represent landlords in politics, for example, they're obviously against these moves by homeowners associations to their ability to own and operate homes. But the argument they put forward, which I think is shared by some other analysts in the housing industry, is that while it may be noble on the one hand to try to preserve homeownership opportunities for more people in a community, there are a lot of people who can't afford to buy these homes, but would be able to rent them. And excluding rental investors, you end up excluding renters who are already having a hard time finding a place they can afford to live and won't be getting any favors if homeowners associations are successful in putting in more of these rules and restrictions.
Will, it sounds like a shortage of affordable housing could be a contributing factor to this whole situation, no?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's part of what's driving everything to this point right now, where you have just an increasing number of people who will rent homes in the suburbs instead of purchasing them, is that's where the demand has shifted. And I think there's absence of serious investment in affordable housing across the country that's not going to let up anytime soon. And absent that, it leaves serious questions about how much restriction of the current housing market should be allowed to exist. And I think state governments in some places have taken a look at the power of homeowners associations and what they can and can't do. And I think we'll likely see more of that if more and more of these communities look to put in more rules.
That was WSJ housing reporter Will Parker. Will, thanks so much for the update.
Thank you.
And finally, Russia's invasion of Ukraine has disrupted supplies of everything from wheat to nickel, jeopardizing global food stockpiles and industrial supply networks. But it's also led musicians to worry about a shortage of glass tubes used in tube-powered amplifiers, many of which are manufactured in Russia. Aficionados say those tubes allow them to crank up their amps while maintaining a warm and creamy tone to the music. WSJ Data News editor Anthony DeBarro says that while savvy guitarists began planning for shortages earlier this year, others have been left scrambling to track down older equipment wherever they can find it.
New old stock tubes are tubes that were made in large quantities in the U.S. for consumer devices and even on military contracts. And a lot of them went unsold, and they've stayed in warehouses for years, or collectors have accumulated them. Typically, they cost more, but they're still out there. So people go hunting for these everywhere from flea markets, on eBay. There are retailers who carry them. But at the end of the day, the supply of those is dwindling because they're not being made in the U.S. anymore.
And that's What's News for Tuesday morning. We'll be back tonight with a new show. I'm Luke Vargas with The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for listening.